Hi everyone, this is Chris Kresser from thehealthyskeptic.org, and I want to welcome you to the first episode of the Healthy Skeptic podcast. Tonight we're going to be talking with Stefan Guyonnet about obesity and weight loss. Stefan's a researcher at the University of Washington studying the neurobiology of fat regulation. He also has a wildly popular blog on nutrition and health called Whole Health Source. So let's get started. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, Chris.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you do?
Yeah, so I study body fat regulation, and in particular the feedback loops that control the level of fat mass in animals and humans. So that's something we'll be getting into in a little more detail later on in the interview, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And you also write a blog, one of my favorite blogs, Whole Health Source. What do you write about there?
Basically, I write about health and nutrition from a traditional food standpoint. So how are cultures eating that are avoiding the problems that we're trying to avoid, basically? And I mix that with a little bit of, with a lot of scientific research from the biomedical literature, as well as some anthropology and archaeology and whatever I can get my hands on that gives me the information I'm looking for.
Great. So we'll, at the end of the interview, we'll give out your blog address for people who haven't seen it yet. And we'll also post a link to it on my blog when I publish the interview.
Great.
So let's dive in. We've been told for a lot of years now to eat less and exercise more, that that's the key to weight loss. So I guess the first place to start is that actually working for us?
Well, you know, that advice has been around for a long time now, and I have to say it's had no discernible effect on the obesity epidemic. You know, if it were that simple, if it were simple and easy, everyone would be doing it, and there wouldn't be an obesity epidemic. So on the surface, I find it rather obvious that it's not working. The fact is, people are actually eating more now than we did 30 years ago. So, I mean, we are eating more, and that is part of the equation. But the question is, why are we eating more? You know, why are people driven to eat more now? And I think it's more complicated than just gluttony. I think that if it were as simple as gluttony, if the problem were that simple, then the solution would be easy and the problem wouldn't exist in the first place, you know?
Right.
So go ahead.
So the problem in part is that we are eating more. It's not that we're eating the same amount or eating less, but we actually are eating more than we were 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's correct. I would say that we're eating considerably more calories than we were 30 years ago. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So why is it so hard to eat less?
Well, basically, the problem is that fat mass is biologically regulated. So it's not just the result of conscious decisions to eat less or exercise more or eat more or whatever. It's a biologically regulated process. So you can think of it in terms of the thermostat in your house, for example. If you have, let's say you have a heater and an air conditioner in your house, you can set your thermostat to turn on the air conditioning if your heat goes above 80, and you can set it to turn on your heat if it goes below 65, and it'll keep the temperature in your house within a fairly narrow range, and they call that a thermostat. So thermo, temperature, stat, the same. And the body has a number of these mechanisms that are designed to keep various things in a particular range. So, for example, there are feedback loops that keep oxygen in the blood in a certain range, without which you would be dead, blood sugar within a certain range, blood pressure, concentration of ions. And it turns out there's a similar mechanism that regulates fat mass. So it's been shown in a number of studies in both animals and humans that if you restrict calories, you can produce fat loss. There's no doubt about that. You also produce a loss of lean body mass. But as soon as you allow that animal or person to eat as much as they want to eat again, they bounce right back up to their original fat mass. And that occurs whether you start with someone who is overweight or someone who's lean. So at least short-term changes in fat mass are compensated for very quickly by the body. And there are a number of mechanisms that are designed to pull fat mass back into the place where the body wants it. And you can call that the adipostat. So adipo means fat and stat means the same. So the body has this mechanism that's designed to maintain fat in a certain range. And the same thing actually occurs with overfeeding. You can get volunteers and you can stuff them with 50% more calories than they would normally eat. They'll gain fat, they'll gain lean mass, their metabolism increases, and then as soon as you stop overfeeding them, they lose the weight completely or almost completely, no matter whether they started off lean or overweight. So there's this feedback mechanism that the body has to try to keep fat in a particular place. And that's the reason why just eating less doesn't work, because if you haven't removed the factor that's causing your body to want to store more fat, it's still going to want to store fat, even though you're not giving it the calories it needs to continue storing fat. So it's going to increase hunger. It's going to decrease metabolic rate. It's going to increase the efficiency of muscular contractions. So your muscles do the same amount of work with less, by expending less energy, decreased body temperature, et cetera. All these things designed to pull as much as possible the fat mass back to the place where it wants it. So basically, you can lose fat by eating less, but you'll be fighting yourself. You're fighting your body as long as you haven't changed where the adipostat is set.
Right. Okay. So let me just see if I can summarize that. So we can both lose weight and gain weight, but certain mechanisms in the body will kick in to restore whatever that natural or whatever body fat set point it is that we're defending. And those mechanisms might include increasing our normal resting metabolic rate, or they might include stimulating increase in appetite, or we might store more calories than we normally do, or we might be motivated to exercise more and move more. Mm-hmm. Is that all part of it?
Yep, you know, absolutely.
So it sounds like the body's really got a mind of its own that's completely independent of our whatever conscious decision we make about, you know, losing or gaining weight.
Absolutely.
So what about exercise? I mean, sounds like we can't control weight loss very well just by making a conscious decision to eat less. What about, you know, exercising more? That's the other part of this equation that we've been told for so many years.
Yeah, so going back to the thermostat analogy, let's say that you have your thermostat set to keep your house at 65 degrees. And it's in the middle of winter. It's 30 degrees outside. And you decide that you want to cool your house down by leaving all the doors open. So you're letting just heat pour out of your house. And what's going to happen? You're basically letting energy out of your house. You're increasing your house's energy expenditure, basically. And what's going to happen, your furnace is going to kick in and it's going to start pumping more energy into your house to maintain that temperature. So if you take this analogy back to exercise, that's the idea behind exercise, is you increase your energy expenditure to reduce the amount of energy you have stored in your body. But the problem with that is you have this adipostat that says, wait a minute, we have all this energy leaving. We better get some more energy into this system to make up for it. And so it's called hunger, you know? So that's basically the reason why typical exercise doesn't cause fat loss, is because it increases hunger, increases calorie intake to compensate, to maintain that fat mass. Now, I'm not saying that I think exercise is a very healthy thing to have a part of your lifestyle, and it has many benefits. But running on a treadmill is not really an effective means to lose body fat if a person is overweight or obese. It's possible that exercise could have a role in preventing obesity, but it's fairly clear from the studies that it's not an effective treatment for obesity.
Right. I remember reading a story about that in Time magazine a while back, and they were talking about this group of women that would go on like a really intense hour-long run, and then afterwards mm-hmm. it would stop at Starbucks and have a muffin and some, you know, like a coffee drink. And what they didn't realize is that they were replacing all of the calories that they had burned in that run, in that single trip to Starbucks. And I think the author was saying how in addition to feeling more hungry after we exercise, there's a tendency for people to feel like they can treat themselves on the mm-hmm. days that they exercise. So they actually not only end up eating more, but often end up eating mm-hmm. you know, more calorically dense foods, maybe more sugar.
Yeah, and what do people eat when they go for a run? They go home and they eat a big old bowl of pasta or something.
Exactly, or even more, you know, maybe some cookies or something, because they feel like they can afford mm-hmm. to do that because
they
exercise.
Earned it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that exercise doesn't burn that many calories. I mean, compared to the amount of energy that you expend just sitting in a chair, keeping up your body temperature and all of your various metabolic processes, exercise really does not burn that many calories.
Yeah, that was really surprising to me when I started to look into how many calories were actually burned, you know, on a mm-hmm. run or something like that. And you're right, it's not very much. And it explains part of the reason why exercise isn't very effective, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, for people who are you know, reading the research on this and even just, you know, in the popular media, there's a big debate in the weight loss world. It seems like there's kind of two polarized schools of thought. One is that the calories in, calories out school. And, you know, they say that the only way to lose weight is to eat fewer calories than you actually burn. It doesn't matter how much protein or carbohydrates or fat you eat. You just need to eat less than you burn, and that's it. The other school is maybe the metabolic advantage school, and they say that cutting carbohydrates, you know, can stimulate certain hormonal changes that lead to weight loss. So who's right, or is it, you know, the truth somewhere in the middle?
Well, I'll just start by talking a little bit about the calories in, calories out theory, because I feel like that needs to be, it's a sticky issue that needs to be defined. So the idea that, I mean, thermodynamics says that the amount of energy that's contained in your body is going to decrease if the amount coming in is lower than the amount coming out, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that basically is thermodynamics, but to extrapolate that, the problem is people take that idea and they extrapolate it. To me, they extrapolate it to think that telling someone to eat less and exercise more is an effective strategy to cause an overweight person to become lean. And that's where you have a disconnect, because there are other factors in the equation. The body is not it's not static. It reacts to changes in energy intake and energy expenditure by trying to compensate. So that's the issue. If you eat fewer calories, your body activates a program that tries to conserve those calories. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the original question. I don't want to get too far off base. Basically, the idea of the metabolic advantage, the idea that there could be differences that are independent of calorie intake on fat gain or fat loss. I don't really know if that's true or not, to be perfectly honest. I think, honestly, it's a little bit of an academic debate, because if you look at low-carbohydrate diet studies, for example, you see that people reduce their calorie intake when they go on those low-carbohydrate diets, and they lose fat. So is the fat loss due to the reduced calorie intake completely? Is it due to that plus some kind of metabolic advantage? I really don't know, but all I know is that they're losing fat and eating less, and I find that interesting. If there is a metabolic advantage, it's probably pretty small. I mean, I would say that more important is the metabolic disadvantage that occurs when you restrict calories. And what I mean by that is that your body reduces its metabolic rate to compensate. And so each fewer calorie that you're eating does not translate into the same amount of fat loss that you would expect it to.
Right. Right. I think
the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, so the calories in, calories out idea, as it's commonly stated, really fails to explain a lot of findings in the biomedical research world. So, for example, you can do a number of things, and Gary Taubes has talked about this quite a bit. There are a number of interventions that you can do in rats, for example, that will make them fat, and that fat cannot be reversed by caloric restriction. They will literally die of starvation, obese, because they will eat their own lean tissue to spare their fat tissue. So basically, their body has decided that fat tissue is so important that it's going to metabolize the lean tissue, the muscle, and the liver, and the brain, and all that stuff, before burning that fat. So those models include female rats where you remove the ovaries, are a model like that. You can lesion certain parts of the hypothalamus in the brain. You can knock out the receptor for the hormone leptin, which is probably the central hormone in the adipostat mechanism, and those rats will hang on to their fat to the death. It doesn't matter how much you calorically restrict them. So I think that's where the calories in, calories out theory fails, is it doesn't account for that dynamic regulation of energy balance, as well as fuel partitioning, so how the body prioritizes where it wants to put energy. Does it want to put energy into the fat mass, or does it want to put it into the lean mass to be burned? That's something that the calories in, calories out theory does not address, and that's a critical factor, possibly even the central factor.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And just getting back to the low-carb diet, you mentioned that people who follow a low-carb diet eat fewer calories, and that happens spontaneously, right? There's, you know, in the studies that I've seen, often when they compare a low-carb diet to a low-fat diet, the researchers tell the low-carb people they can eat however much they want, and they tell the low-fat people a specific number of calories to eat, mm-hmm. and the low-carb people end up eating fewer calories anyways. Mm-hmm. What do you think that's about?
Well, I'm speculating here, but I think that points to the possibility that low-carbohydrate diets, at least in some people, are able to reset that adipostat mechanism. So making the body want to carry less fat mass, at least in some people. Because if you didn't tell somebody to eat fewer calories, why are they going to eat fewer calories? You know, maybe the food doesn't taste bad or something, or doesn't taste good or something like that would be the typical explanation. But I don't, I think that's very unlikely because, I mean, the food you eat on a low carbohydrate diet, first of all, is pretty tasty.
Yeah, exactly. Most people
and,
like.
I think it just points to possibly a change to adipostat. The brain is saying, hey, you know what? I don't think we need quite as much fat, so why don't we lay off on the calories a little bit and we'll let some of that go.
Well, it certainly seems like that. I mean that sounds totally reasonable to me, and I'm curious what the long-term studies that have been done on low carb diets show, because from what I've seen, there isn't the effect tends to diminish over time, which makes me wonder if, you know, if the set point is being adjusted or reduced, why aren't these people continuing to lose weight, or why doesn't the weight stay off over, you know, like period of 18 months, for example?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. And if you can take 100 people and put them on a low carbohydrate diet and they all lose, let's say, you know, 10 pounds or 20 pounds at 6 months, and then they've gained it all back at a year, but they were eating the exact same diet the whole time, then you could say, oh, well, you know, it probably didn't reset the set point, the adipostat. It probably just temporarily reduced fat mass and then bounced back. But the problem with these studies is there's another factor. There's adherence to the experimental diet.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not sure how much of that is due to people not eating the diet as much anymore and how much of it is due to an actual rebounding of the body. Because, I mean, you look at these studies and the adherence definitely decreases over time. That, you know, people are really gung-ho at first. They're following the diet to the T the first couple months. Lose a bunch of weight, or lose a bunch of fat, excuse me. And then after a few months, they say, hey, you know, I kind of like bread. Maybe I'm going to eat some more bread. Maybe I'm going to eat some more pasta. And it kind of creeps back in. So I can't say for sure how much of the effect is due to the set point kicking back in and how much of it is simply due to adherence. But I will say that I do know, at least on an anecdotal level, I know individuals who have had long-term success on low-carbohydrate diets, and that, to me, suggests that there really is a re-regulation of the fat mass set point, at least in some people. And, in fact, someone that I know very well went on a low-carbohydrate diet, and it was really, it was pretty miraculous, honestly. Not only did her weight stabilize to an appropriate level, but instead of starving herself constantly for years, she was able to eat to fullness and not have to obsess over food for the first time in maybe a decade. And that was a huge transformation for her. And that, to me, that suggests that really the adipostat has been changed. If you can eat as much as you want and you're full and you have an appropriate level of body fat, then your adipostat is working correctly as far as I'm concerned, you know?
Yeah, and she doesn't care what the studies say because her life's been totally changed. And I actually know quite a few people like that as well. My dad's one of them. He's been on a low carb diet for several years, and he's he's stuck with it really closely, both because he's seen good results, and I think he just likes to eat that way now. But he's had really, really good results, and I know that. If I don't have an issue with weight. In fact, I'm, if anything, generally trying to gain weight. But if I start eating a lot of carbohydrates, that's one way that I can put weight on. And if I follow a really low carbohydrate diet, it you know, I have a really hard time keeping weight on. So I think there is something to it, and I agree that we don't, you know, the studies, we'll never probably know, because to do a long-term metabolic ward study, you know, of 18 months or 2 years, it's just so expensive.
Yeah.
It's unlikely to happen. And there's really no incentive, of course, for the, you know, the drug companies to fund a study like that. So, okay, well, let's move on. I think we've covered a lot of good stuff so far, and I want to start talking a little bit about some of the factors that have that are being looked at recently in the literature. One of them is this idea that changes in our gut flora actually have something to do with obesity. Mm-hmm. And I know you recently presented a paper on this, so you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I'll start from the beginning. In 2004, Jeffrey Gordon's group had a finding where they showed that if you take germ-free mice, so these are mice that don't have any kind of gut flora at all, they're resistant to diet-induced obesity. So you can put them on the same diet that makes a regular mouse fat, and they will not get fat. That finding has actually been challenged by a recent paper that showed that germ-free mice of a different strain are actually more susceptible to diet-induced obesity. But in any case, the fact is the gut flora influence fat mass. The gut flora exert a powerful effect on fat mass. And since that 2004 paper, there have been a number of further experiments that have come out, further papers that have been published in this field, showing that you can actually transfer obesity between animals, between mice, by transferring their gut flora between one another. So you can take a mouse that's obese, you can take its gut flora, put it into a germ-free mouse, and it will make that mouse obese, whereas gut flora from a lean mouse would not make that mouse obese. So there's quite a bit of evidence right now in animal literature that it's a major factor in body fat, but not only body fat, also metabolic syndrome, all the things associated with it, like insulin resistance and high and dyslipidemia and that sort of thing. So it's also been shown in humans that there are some associations between obesity and gut flora, and the research hasn't really gotten to the point where we're testing ways of modifying the gut flora yet. Well, I take that back. There are some ways that the gut flora have been modified. I'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. But there's another researcher by the name of Rémy Burcelin. He's in Toulouse, I think, France, and he has put out a number of papers showing that gut flora are intimately linked with obesity and metabolic syndrome in mice, and he can actually block many of those changes, many of those diet-induced obesity and metabolic syndrome changes, by feeding the mice certain types of fermentable fibers. So those are soluble fibers that get chewed up and fermented by the gut flora and promote the growth of certain beneficial flora. And you can basically prevent all the metabolic and body fat effects of these obesity-inducing diets in rodents with this fiber.
So those are prebiotics we're talking about, right?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Prebiotics. And the particular one that he's studied the most is called inulin. Mm-hmm. It's a polymer of fructose that's found in certain types of root vegetables, mostly in the sunflower family.
Jerusalem artichokes, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, Jerusalem artichokes, burdock, jicama, chicory, and then there's also in leeks and onions in smaller amounts.
Mm-hmm. So,
I just wanted to say one more thing about that. Sorry to interrupt.
Of course.
I just wanted to say that those findings have been largely confirmed in humans as well using fermentable fibers. So there were papers showing that it increases insulin sensitivity and can cause modest fat loss in humans as well.
Yeah, that this is just so fascinating to me because I'm reading so much research lately about the role of gut flora in just about every modern disease.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the mechanisms for how gut flora contributes to obesity, it seems like there's a couple different theories, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one is that the changes in gut flora actually stimulate an increase in appetite, so people end up eating more. And another is that a change in gut flora actually alters the absorption of calories from food, and that certain gut flora permit us to get energy from food that we wouldn't otherwise get if we didn't have that gut flora. Is that right?
Yeah, so I don't really subscribe to the second theory because, I mean, it has been shown that certain types of gut flora are more efficient at extracting calories from food. But the fact is, if you believe in this adipostat theory, the body should be able to compensate for it's really a minuscule amount of calories we're talking about, the difference between the amount extracted between different types of gut flora. We're talking about a very small amount of energy. And if you believe that we have an adipostat that can regulate fat mass, then it should just tell the animal, why don't you eat half a mouthful less of food today because we got a little bit extra from the gut flora. So that theory, I'm not so hot on. That is one that Jeff Gordon has used to explain his initial findings. I think it's a pretty unlikely explanation. Another thing that argues against that is the fact that is this recent paper showing that at least under certain conditions, germ-free mice are more susceptible to diet-induced obesity than mice that have normal gut flora. So, I mean, that theory just can't explain a result like that.
Right.
So I think the only way to reconcile it is to say these bacteria are having a specific metabolic hormonal effect on the organism that is either predisposing to or preventing fat gain and metabolic syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it doesn't sound that far-fetched. I know, parasites can cause certainly cravings for certain foods, and it just makes sense to me that certain, pathogenic bacteria or just certain different types of bacteria could cause similar cravings. So, what about inflammation? I mean, insulin resistance is often talked about in terms of weight gain, but it seems like we're seeing a lot of studies recently suggesting that inflammation instead of insulin resistance, or not instead of, but in addition to, could be a driving force. What do you think about that?
Driving force for fat gain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, insulin resistance and obesity go hand in hand, and it's difficult to say, but if I had to go away one way or another, I would say insulin resistance itself is probably not a major factor in obesity, and maybe I'll end up eating my words one day, but that is what I think.
There are some studies of overweight people and even kids who aren't insulin resistant, right?
Correct.
And that low-carb diets reduce insulin resistance, but even over the long term, they don't, over 18 months, when you look at those studies, the weight gain is the same. And I know we have to consider the adherence issue that you mentioned before. And then there are studies that, have shown that chemicals and plastic that cause inflammation can also cause weight gain. So I'm kind of curious about how that all fits together.
Yeah. So this adipostat that we talked about, for the most part, it resides in the hypothalamus in the brain. So that's a region that regulates many of these feedback loops that control different aspects of the metabolism. I don't want to say that it's exclusively in the hypothalamus, but that's certainly a major site of where this adipostat is. So there are a few different theories on, so let me back up a step. Basically, the problem with obesity, all right, so you have this adipostat. If it were always working correctly, then no one would be overweight, no one would be obese. So you have to ask the question, you know, if we have this adipostat, how can anyone ever become overweight? And the answer, the likely answer is that the signal, the feedback signal is not getting to the adipostat. So basically, there's a hormone called leptin that's secreted by fat mass and is proportional to the amount of fat that you carry. And that signals to the hypothalamus to react to the level of leptin that it's sensing. So if it's too little leptin because you don't have enough fat, makes you hungry, makes you lethargic, etc. If it senses you have too much fat, then it increases metabolism, increases energy expenditure, decreases hunger. So basically, the theory is, and there's a lot of good evidence to support this, both in animals and humans, is that the signal, the leptin, and, you know, I don't want to say leptin is the only signal regulating fat mass. Mm-hmm. I don't want to imply that, but it's certainly a central mechanism, possibly the central mechanism. Basically, that signal is not getting to the hypothalamus. So let's say you have the same amount of leptin, but the hypothalamus is only getting half the signal. So what's going to happen? Your fat mass is going to drift up. It's going to keep on increasing until it's doubled, until the amount of leptin signal that the hypothalamus is hearing from the body is at the same level. And then it's going to stop. It's going to stabilize there. And then if at that point it is only hearing, you know, if the next year, then it loses more leptin sensitivity and you only hear half of that signal, then your fat mass is going to double again. So it's just like insulin sensitivity. It's the amount of leptin signaling that occurs is proportional to the amount of leptin circulating as well as to the ability of the hypothalamus to receive that leptin. So there are three main hypotheses right now about how that happens. And inflammation is one of them, and I'll get back to that in just one second. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention the other theories. One theory that's pioneered by this guy, William Banks, who I just actually heard a lecture by today, is that there's a problem with leptin transport into the brain from the bloodstream across what's called the blood-brain barrier. And his theory is that triglycerides or blood fats block leptin transport into the hypothalamus, and that causes the hypothalamus to not receive the signal. That theory is interesting. I think it needs some more work, but it's highly plausible. It's highly plausible. And then there's a guy called Umut Ozcan who is studying ER stress. Endoplasmic reticulum stress. It's a type of cellular stress. And he feels that that's involved in leptin resistance. I think that theory still needs a lot more work as well. Mm. And then there's my own mentor, Michael Schwartz, and another person, Dongshen Kai, who are studying the hypothesis that inflammation in the hypothalamus is behind leptin resistance and fat gain. And you can show that inflammation causes the cells in the hypothalamus to not respond to the leptin signal as well. They basically ignore it, even if there's a bunch of it around. And if you reverse that leptin resistance, if you prevent that leptin resistance, you prevent the development of obesity in animal models. And so this theory ties back into the gut flora one, because one of the leading hypotheses of how the gut flora causes these problems is it basically causes a low-grade systemic inflammation originating from the gut, which could potentially have inflammatory effects throughout the body, including the hypothalamus.
That's fascinating. So just to kind of recap, we have what's supposed to happen is that as we gain weight, the leptin signals the hypothalamus as we gain fat, to decrease our hunger and increase our activity levels and just do the things that you explained earlier to maintain the set point.
Correct.
But for some reason, and there are, you know, the three theories that you just described, that's not happening in people that are gaining weight. And that could be because of inflammation, which could be at least in part caused by gut flora, or it could be because triglycerides are blocking the leptin from crossing the blood-brain barrier, or it could be because of, was it cellular stress?
Endoplasmic reticulum stress. Uh-huh.
But that theory is not very well developed yet.
Yeah, it's plausible. It's highly plausible. I just feel like I'm not convinced enough by the papers that have been published at this point. I think it needs more work.
Mm-hmm. Well, something interesting, I don't know very much at all about the third theory, but just the first and second theory, the gut flora dysregulation causing the inflammation and then the triglycerides blocking the leptin, it seems to me that those could be two other reasons that the low-carb diet is effective in some people, because, of course, a high-carbohydrate diet increases triglycerides, and a high-carbohydrate diet will also feed certain species of gut gut bacteria.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that certainly, the triglyceride hypothesis certainly lends credence to the low-carb, or is consistent with the effects of low carbohydrate diets in some people. One of the things he said today in a lecture that I wasn't aware of before is you basically have to get your triglycerides down below 100 mg per deciliter to see that effect. That if you don't get them down to that level, I'm speaking about his animal models. In his animal models, you have to get it below that level to see the fat loss effect. So, but I mean, it's pretty common for people on low carbohydrate diets to have triglycerides below 100. And I mean, I do in my,
sure.
I'm not even on a low carbohydrate diet, and mine are that low, but, what was I going to say? Oh yeah. Well, the carbohydrate thing, I mean, I think you have to distinguish between refined and unrefined carbohydrates, because if you're eating whole food carbohydrates, you're going to be feeding beneficial bacteria as well, because they like to feed on the fiber that's contained in those foods. If you're eating just refined carbohydrates like sugar and white flour, you're creating an environment where the bacteria you don't want to grow can grow in the upper intestinal tract, and the bacteria that you do want to grow can't grow in the lower intestinal tract.
Right, because the carbohydrate's so simple that it doesn't make it all the way down to the lower intestinal tract.
Yeah, not much makes it down there, and so the bacteria don't have much to eat. You end up with a low bacterial count and simplified structure, simplified community of bacteria down there.
And that could explain, it seems like, the observation that, obesity and diabetes were low in the U.S. back when carbohydrate consumption was still fairly high, but the carbohydrates that they were eating then were whole grains and not, highly refined carbs.
Yeah, that's true to some extent. I mean, if you go back 100 years, though, people were mostly eating white flour in this country. But it was probably somewhat different than what they eat today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think refined carbohydrates, you know, by that, let me take a step back. By that, I mean that they were treating their white flour differently than today. It was more like a long fermentation type process. I think that refined carbohydrates are one factor, and certainly not the only factor.
What about industrial seed oils? Because these have obviously, you know, our consumption of these, you know, like cotton seed and sunflower and these corn oil and soybean oil, these highly refined seed oils has just risen mm-hmm. dramatically over the past, you know, from the turn of the 20th century to, you know, I guess they've gone down a little bit in the last few years. But what role do you think those might be playing, especially vis-a-vis the inflammation hypothesis?
Yeah, well, if you say the word inflammation, the first thing I think about is omega-6 and omega-3 fats, because they're so critical in determining how the body responds to stimuli that cause immune reactions or inflammation. So the balance between omega-6 and omega-3 fats determine how the body reacts to harmful stimuli. So there were a couple of really interesting papers that came out in the last year showing that if you feed mice a diet that is imbalanced in omega-3 and omega-6 polyunsaturated fats, they develop progressive obesity. They develop progressive obesity that gets worse over 3 to 4 generations of mice. So basically what your great grandparents ate could be influencing how much body fat you carry today is one thing that those experiments suggest is a possibility in humans as well.
Wow.
The implications are pretty profound.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it ties in well with the hypothalamic inflammation theory, because if we're eating something that is predisposing us to inflammation throughout our entire bodies, then, you know, some inflammatory thing that wouldn't have been a problem on a different diet, maybe that's going to cause a massive inflammatory reaction in the hypothalamus and lead to obesity if we're imbalanced in the favor of omega-6. So just to give a little word for people who aren't familiar with the terminology, omega-6 is a polyunsaturated fat that's mostly found in seed oils like corn oil and soybean oil and cotton seed oil and safflower oil. And basically, we're eating probably 4 or 5 times as much as we were even just 100 years ago. And you go back 200 years and it was even less. And all the while, our omega-3 intake has been relatively stable or even slightly increasing over the course of the last 100 years, because some seed oils, such as soybean and canola oil, do contain some omega-3, but the two compete with one another in some ways, and so basically you're negating the benefits of the omega-3s by excessively consuming omega-6s.
Right, and just to, you know, so everyone understands, the prostaglandins, the compounds that are formed from omega-6 fatty acids are more pro-inflammatory, whereas those formed from omega-3s are less inflammatory.
Yeah, I mean, in broad strokes. Mm-hmm. So the polyunsaturated omega-6 and omega-3 fats are the precursors of both eicosanoids and endocannabinoids. So those are two compounds that have massive effects on body weight and feeding behaviors. Like, for example, you know, the word endocannabinoid, you take the word cannabinoid, the word comes from cannabis, because It's basically the molecule that the body produces that hits the same receptor as marijuana does. So what happens when you smoke marijuana? You want to eat a lot of food, right?
Uh-huh, so the munchies.
Exactly. So that shows that those cannabinoids are very potent regulators of feeding behavior. And there's actually a drug called Rimonabant that is a weight loss drug. It was recently taken off the market for side effect reasons, but it does cause fat loss in humans. And it's basically reverse marijuana. It blocks the receptor that marijuana activates.
Yeah, that's fascinating too, and it seems like another big piece of the story, especially because we're eating so much more of these oils now. I know Cordain and others have done some anthropological work that suggests that the ratio of omega 6 to omega 3 was maybe 1 to 1 back in the our paleo hunter gatherer ancestors times, and I've seen recently the estimate that we're eating 10 times more omega 6 than omega 3, and in some people that number could be as high as 20 to 25 times as much.
Yep.
And I just based on what we've been talking about so far, there seems like there would be pretty dramatic consequences from getting that far away.
Yeah, I believe there are. I think the consequences are massive. And one of the problems with the research is that we're talking about very long-term things. I mean, this is not the kind of thing where you take a fish oil capsule and the next day you wake up thin, or you wake up insulin sensitive or whatever. It's really a very long-term effect that is probably more effective as a preventative measure than it is as a treatment.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about prevention and treatment. A couple questions. There's, in general, we know that exercise, cardio type of exercise isn't helpful for weight loss, but it seems like I have seen a few studies that suggest that high intensity exercise might be more effective than cardio. Is that true?
Yeah, well, there's at least one study that suggests that it is effective for fat loss. My opinion on that is that it is very interesting, and I think it's highly plausible, and I think that it should be confirmed by more research. But, I have no reservations recommending high-intensity exercise as part of a fat loss attempt, as long as it's done in a way that is not overboard. If you're exercising at a very high level of intensity, you have to make sure that you're giving yourself adequate rest to allow your body to repair,
to recover, and come back to baseline, and then more.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And so in the study that you're referring to, was it like a high intensity aerobic training or resistance training? Do you know?
Yeah, it was actually cycle sprints.
Cycle sprints,
so,
right.
Yep, stationary bike. And they had overweight women, I believe they were overweight women, do stationary bicycle sprints, and they lost fat mass over the course of a few months, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds familiar now. And what about intermittent fasting? That frequently comes up in the paleo communities as another potential way of changing the set point. What do you think?
Well, I'll say a few things about that. So the first thing I'll say is that there is remarkably little in the human literature on intermittent fasting that would suggest that it's effective for fat loss. And by that, I mean that it hasn't been directly tested in a way that I would find satisfying. But on the other hand, it's not that it's been tried and it doesn't work. It just hasn't really been tested in a satisfactory way, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I was at this lecture today, by this guy, what was his name? slipping my mind right now. Anyway, oh yeah, William Banks. Yeah, that lecture I went to today.
Right.
He said he showed in his animals that fasting, short-term fasting, so 16-hour fasts, increased the amount of leptin that was transported into the hypothalamus in overweight rats, or mice, I think. So basically, it could potentially be used as a way to sensitize the hypothalamus to leptin, so to allow that adipostat to hear the signal that the fat mass is putting out. And and anecdotally, there are a lot of people who have had great success with it. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, I still have my skeptic hat on, but try it, give it a shot. I think that it's highly plausible. You know, it's basically, it's a type of hormesis or a stimulus that is a stressor, a mild stressor that increases resistance to greater stressors. So exercise is a type of hormesis. You put a stress on your body and it adapts in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it highly plausible that intermittent fasting could be doing something similar. Again, I would like to see it tested rigorously, but I don't think it's going to hurt anybody at this point. So I say, you know, give it a shot, give it a try.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like there is a plausible mechanism and just, you know, some at least anecdotal evidence. And for a lot of people, that's probably enough, especially since it's not, there doesn't sound like there's any negative consequences from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, the more I've been thinking about this recently, it seems like there's a real paradigm shift happening in the understanding of obesity, where it was previously considered to be, you know, just primarily a metabolic disorder, or even a psychological disorder. At one point, you know, people just couldn't stop themselves from eating and, or couldn't make themselves exercise enough because they weren't disciplined enough. And now it seems like, you know, obviously there are metabolic factors and, you know, in some people there may be psychological factors, of course, too, but it also seems like there are immunological factors and even that you could say obesity is an immune disorder in some way. And if that's true, it seems like it changes our focus on how we prevent it and treat it. So could you talk a little bit about, two things. First of all, just prevention, since it seems like prevention, we know a lot more about prevention than we do about treatment at this point with these new strategies. And then, you know, maybe tell us a little bit about treatment. Like if somebody came to you and was overweight and asked you what they thought they should do, what would you recommend?
Okay. So, just to dwell for a moment on what you said about obesity and metabolic syndrome being immunological, I think that you're absolutely right with that. And it's been a huge trend, and it's been a huge research trend. There's a lot of data to suggest that insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome has a very strong immune component, and inflammation is, just to fill people in, inflammation is a type of immune reaction. It's one class of immune reaction. And basically, if you can take animal models and you can block inflammation, and they will not develop the type of insulin resistance and metabolic disorders that an animal would develop if they had the capacity to have normal inflammation. So it won't block the obesity if you block it. The problem is most of these treatments don't actually act in the brain. So, you know, the hypothalamus is in the brain. But if you block obesity in the rest of the body, it blocks like the insulin resistance and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually take diabetic patients, human diabetic patients, And if you infuse their blood with enough anti-inflammatory drug, you can get rid of most of their insulin resistance. Suggesting that, yeah, you can do it with basically with aspirin. Mm-hmm. If you put enough directly into the bloodstream, they become almost as insulin sensitive as a normal person, a type 2 diabetic. So that suggests that insulin is tightly involved in insulin resistance.
Mm-hmm. And that insulin resistance might be secondary to inflammation.
That's correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. that is probably at least true to a large extent. I can't say that that's the exclusive reason, but to a large extent it is.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of prevention, the way that I always like to think is, what are people doing who aren't gaining fat mass? You know, what are cultures doing where it doesn't matter who you are, you don't get fat? And basically, what they're eating is a traditional whole foods diet based around traditionally prepared micronutrient dense foods. And it's a mixture, it's always a mixture between, well, always, I don't want to say always, but typically I would say that the healthiest cultures eat a mixture of both animal and plant foods that have lived their lives, been harvested and prepared in traditional manner.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look, you know, you can see what these people eat and see that they don't become overweight, they don't get the metabolic diseases we have, and you can see that when these cultures adopt Western foods, they develop the same problems that we have. And then you can go ahead.
Let's talk just, you know, I'm sure most of our listeners probably already know this, but let's talk a little bit about what wasn't in those diets. Maybe that's an easier way to get at it.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's always easier to talk about what wasn't in those diets because they were extremely diverse, from cultures that were essentially the pure carnivores to cultures that were eating very starchy plant-based diets, and basically none of them were getting sick as long as they ate a traditional diet. So the things they weren't eating was sugar. And when I say sugar, I'm talking about refined sugar. They did, mm-hmm. Some of these cultures got sugar from fruit or honey or that sort of thing.
Right.
They were not eating white flour. White flour, pretty much wherever it shows up throughout the world, metabolic havoc ensues.
Mm-hmm.
And tooth decay and all that stuff. They were not eating industrial seed oils. So there are traditional oils that cultures used, but they're very different from the modern oils that we use today. Things like palm oil and coconut oil and animal fats were, you know, and olive oil as well, were really the main cooking oils of traditional healthy cultures in many parts of the world.
The oils that you could get without large factories and machines.
And industrial solvents, you know,
right.
I mean, it really, honestly, I think if the average person knew what the true process is that goes into making something like soybean or corn oil, I don't think they would eat it anymore. I mean, it's just disgusting.
I agree. I had a slide in a presentation that I give on cholesterol and heart disease that has a schematic of all the steps that mm-hmm. vegetable oil processing, you know, processing of a vegetable oil goes through, and people were pretty grossed out by the end of the description of the slide.
Yeah, it's revolting. I mean, yeah. How can you even consider that food, honestly?
Yeah. So no flour, no white sugar, no industrial refined seed oils.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Well, I think processed food in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other things that showed up at the time that these cultures developed metabolic problems, like canned, low-quality meats like turkey tails. I mean, turkey tails are something that's kind of ubiquitous in the processed food culture of South Sea Island cultures that have become extremely unhealthy. And it's remarkable in that among animal fats, turkey fat contains a very high proportion of omega-6
mm-hmm.
polyunsaturated fat. So, I mean, it's really like the bottom of the barrel in terms of animal foods.
Right.
And just processed food in general, you know, it's just not, doesn't contain enough nutrition, doesn't contain enough fermentable fiber. And in the case of white flour, it can be immunogenic. It can stimulate the immune system in a negative way. And then sugar can cause overgrowth of harmful bacteria. So, I mean, you just have this basically a potent brew that very rapidly destroys the health of traditional cultures, just as it has destroyed our own culture's health.
Right. So we have, you know, pretty much just eat food that it comes the way it comes in nature, and don't eat stuff that comes in a bag or a box as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
stay away from white flour and sugar in particular, refined grains and mm-hmm. and industrial seed oils, which, you know, some people may not be aware. You know, I don't know that many people that are cooking with soybean oil anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But what some people don't realize is that pretty much all restaurant foods are cooked in these oils, and that a lot of packaged foods have, you know, these oils in them as well. So
mm-hmm.
that they're
Absolutely.
Pretty insidious. I think I read recently that 20% of calories from the American diet come from these seed oils, or just actually soybean oil, I think,
mm-hmm.
was the statistic, which is just crazy.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, yeah, if you think about the types of fats that we've been eating for the last few million years, it's a complete departure just in the last 100 years. And to me, what's insane is that there's no alarm bells going off, or barely anyone is saying, whoa, 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 you know, we have these extremely bioactive fats that all of a sudden we're loading down our diets with. This has got to have some kind of effect, you know, and it's not going to be positive. But
yeah.
most people don't. Doesn't even occur to them.
No, and we've been looking in the wrong places for a lot of years, and that's definitely a subject for another conversation. Probably we could talk a long time about that, I'm sure. But okay, so prevention we're talking about, and that, those are the dietary factors. You mentioned earlier that exercise may have, you know, play some role in you know, maintaining the set point, maybe by just, do you think that maybe just maintaining insulin and leptin sensitivity is part of that, or?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it does, is mm-hmm. maintains metabolic health. And mm-hmm. I think that if high intensity exercise is able to reduce the body fat, it's because it's having a metabolic effect. It's not the calories. Yeah, that's exactly what I would say. And it's been shown that exercise reduces inflammation measurable in the blood. So it's plausible that it reduces inflammation in other places as well and increases hormone sensitivity.
Right. What about fermented foods? You know, it seems like a lot of traditional cultures, or at least some traditional cultures, ate fermented foods, and that might have benefited their gut flora.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. I think I've been thinking about this somewhat lately, and there's basically two ways to alter your gut flora. One is by eating bacteria and yeast and whatever from fermented foods or probiotics. And that is largely something it's mostly going to influence your upper intestinal tract, as far as I understand it. So
mm-hmm.
your small intestine.
Right.
Because by the time you get down to the large intestine, I mean, your large intestine is basically a big bacterial reactor, like it's full of trillions of bacteria. And there's no amount of probiotic that you can eat that's even going to make a drop of difference in that enormous mass of bacteria in your large intestine. So the way I see it, that sort of thing is really going to mostly influence your upper intestinal tract, but that can be important because, you know, upper intestinal tract, I know you've been writing about gastroesophageal reflux disorder recently and how that interacts possibly with bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. And those are things that you can influence possibly by eating fermented foods and probiotics,
right,
by competing with those harmful organisms. And it's also been shown that, so we haven't really talked much about intestinal permeability, but it's been shown that you can increase the ability of the gut to keep inflammatory molecules out of the blood by giving probiotics.
Mm-hmm.
So you decrease intestinal permeability in the small intestine, which could be important.
Right.
And then for the large intestine, the way you alter the gut flora there is with the fermentable fibers. So that's where the fermentation takes place. So basically, you know, it's kind of a 1-2 punch if you're doing fermented foods and fermentable fiber in your diet. So it's prebiotics and probiotics.
Right, which they call synbiotics, or they, it seems like that's,
yeah, that's
term,
right,
that they're throwing around now.
It's the new fancy term for eating sauerkraut and vegetables.
Right, of course, they need a term so that they can make patented products and make lots of money off of them.
Exactly.
Well, that's great, and I actually a colleague of mine, a doctor who I really like, he says that you know, antibiotics were the medicine of the 20th century, and probiotics and prebiotics are going to be the medicine of the 21st century, and it certainly seems like it's shaping up to be that way. Although you could argue that probiotics and prebiotics were the medicine of the previous, you know, millions of years of evolution.
Yeah, we just, that's right,
got a little off track there for a while.
Well, I hope he's right. I hope he's right.
Yeah. Okay, so prevention, we've got, you know, mostly dietary, keep exercising and making sure we're getting enough of the fermentable fibers and the fermented foods to maintain healthy gut flora. So what about somebody who is already overweight and, you know, their set point is not where they want it to be? What, you know, I'm all of the things we've already talked about for prevention, I'm sure, would be part of the program, but why don't you talk a little bit about
sure,
treatment?
So, basically, I'm just going to outline a toolbox. I mean, it depends on the individual, so I'm just going to outline a toolbox of potential strategies that one could consider if one wanted to lose weight or wanted to lose fat, and the exact strategy that you would apply would depend on the individual, but some of those, some possibilities are reducing the carbohydrate content of the diet, and I'm not really sold on going extreme on that. I think that a moderate reduction in carbohydrates is probably a better idea unless you're diabetic or almost diabetic.
So for those who, you know, who like to know the numbers, do you have anything in mind, like less than 75 grams of carbs a day, or are you just kind of pointing more towards, I don't know, more qualitative reduction?
I mean, I tend to think more in terms of percentages, just because that's the way I've always thought about it. So I apologize, I can't off the top of my head give you a gram amount, but I would say that I would start to get uncomfortable if someone was going below maybe 20% carbohydrate for the long term. I don't know. I mean, I think it probably works for some people, but I think there are a lot of people who just end up not benefiting from that in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to listen to what your body is saying.
Right. Okay. So low, you know, moderately reducing carbohydrate intake.
Yeah, and then basically ensuring a nutrient dense diet. So make sure that you're covering, that you're eating nutrient dense food. So eat pasture-raised eggs and dairy, if tolerated. Dairy can actually be problematic for some people, but if you tolerate it well, and pasture-raised meats, organ meats in particular, like liver, butter, and then root vegetables, sweet potatoes, taro, and vegetables, you know, especially vegetables with a high content of fermentable fiber, like onions and mushrooms and Jerusalem artichokes, burdock, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nuts and fruit, basically whole foods diet.
Right.
And then grains as well. I think grains can be part of the equation. I think that some people may benefit from not eating grains at all, but I think that most people, if they're prepared properly, can have grains in the diet and do fine. I think that many traditional cultures have shown that it's a feasible part of a diet.
Right, and you've been writing about the types of preparation that those cultures did and that are required to so that grains are actually healthful for us rather than
right.
Problematic.
Right.
So, okay, so we've got nutrient-dense diet, everything we talked about for prevention, the probiotics, maybe high-intensity training, if somebody wants to try that, and possibly intermittent fasting. Sounds like, you know, just everything that promotes general health and wellness, but specifically those things that reduce inflammation and improve, you know, insulin and leptin signaling, which is, you know, pretty much everything that we've been talking about tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then another factor is, I believe, that food sensitivities can also contribute to elevated fat mass. And there are people who, they'll, for example, stop eating wheat. I think that's got to be one of the most common ones. And just from eliminating wheat, they'll lose 15 or 20 pounds of fat.
Wow.
Over the next few months. And I think that there are people who have a similar reaction to dairy as well and other foods. I think wheat is a particularly common one.
Just wheat or any gluten-containing grains?
Well, I think wheat is the worst offender, especially white flour, but there are certainly a lot of people who are sensitive to gluten found in wheat, rye, and barley. And, you know, the classical disease of gluten sensitivity is celiac disease, and that traditionally was thought of as kind of a wasting disease where people were very lean because they weren't able to absorb the nutrients from their food. But now that we're testing more people and finding more people with celiac disease, there are quite a few people who are overweight who have celiac disease. And in fact, people who have gluten sensitivity but not celiac disease, which is very common, probably at least 1 out of 10 people, probably more, those people are just as likely to be overweight, if not more so, than the general population. So I think that food sensitivity is a big one, and that can contribute to gut problems and inflammation throughout the body as well.
Wow, we've covered a lot of ground tonight.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting to me in a way that, you know, this that we're really beginning to understand this in a new way, in a new way, and hopefully in a way that brings more success, you know, than mm-hmm. the previous paradigm.
Yeah.
You know, instead of people focusing on cutting calories or going to running on the treadmill endlessly in the gym, we focus more on basically improving our immune system and reducing mm-hmm. inflammation in the body. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, everything that does that is going to benefit not just our weight, but our overall health and our ability to you know, prevent other diseases, since all diseases pretty much have an inflammation component to them, it sounds like the things that we would do to prevent and to treat weight gain are just the things that we need to be doing anyways to promote overall good health. And that always makes me feel good. You know, it makes a lot of sense to me when things add up like that. I feel naturally distrustful of strategies that, to treat a particular condition that would send our general health in a bad direction.
Yeah, agreed.
So thank you so much, Stefan. It's been great. I'm sorry we went a little over the time that I had planned, but it's just... I get off on talking about this stuff. It's really interesting to me. So thanks again, and hopefully we can do it again sometime soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
All right.